Need a new set of optics? For more than a decade, Riton Optics has been providing optic solutions for hunters and shooters of all types and disciplines. Check out their Primal line for those products geared more towards us hunters. From binoculars and spotting scopes to your basic 3-9 scopes and longer range crossover models, the Primal line from Riton was made for hunters. Learn more at RitonOptics.com. That's Riton, R-I-T-O-N, Optics.com.
You got a beer there, Greg? Atta girl.
This is the OKest Hunter Podcast. Never pass on shooter bucks, because that's just me in the freezer. It's your tag. You hunt how you want. This is OKest Hunter.
Heyo! Welcome to the OKest Hunter Podcast. We are live. We stream live every Tuesday. We don't really miss a lot of Tuesdays. I don't remember the last one we would miss. Maybe Christmas or something, but Tuesdays from 6 p.m. Central Standard Time till when we're done, usually about 7:30, hour and a half. So if you're hearing this new for the first time, you're new to the show, I'm Eric, one of the hosts here. We got Greg on the other side of the screen. Usually we're all here in studio, but weather threw some curveballs at us. A couple of us in the Clark household are not super healthy. I don't think we're super sick, but no need to expose people to germs. Derek is knee-deep in kids stuff, so he's not here. But we do have a guest we'll bring on in just a minute. So a couple of, announcements, I suppose. We have a new presenting sponsor, a partner for the OKS Hunter Podcast. So we are now presented by, and these things will change, guys and gals. Like, ad dollars change like the wind. It's just how it works. And we've turned down some partners because we don't believe in making decisions for money. We believe in making decisions that fit with us and fit with y'all as our listeners. So we got to do some fun experimentations. Oh, man, that's not the right word to call it. With Nosler Ammunition last fall. They were kind enough to send us some ammunition for all our rifles. So Greg, me, Derek, Matt, Tyler, we all got to shoot Nosler last year, and I think it went well.
Yeah.
Yeah, he says, the doe slayer. You were one shot, one kill with each one of those does, weren't you?
Dude, I'm happy when a shell goes bang and a deer falls down. And I've had other, you know, brands of ammunition. I've had some that, you know, we'll call it budget ammo, that pull the trigger and it just goes click.
Oh, wow. That had my dad once, actually.
And it's not cool. Like,
a loud noise.
Yeah, it is the loudest click you'll ever hear in your life. Even if the deer's 200 yards away, it's mm-hmm. still, I swear to God, that deer
can gunshot.
Yeah, you can hear the hear the primer get struck and nothing happen. Every shot went bang. Every bullet went where it was supposed to go. And it's great stuff. If you're going to spend money on anything, there's a couple things, but I think ammunition is one thing because that has to go off. It has to work in your gun. From field to table, just ask what caliber. All of us are shooting a 30 caliber of some sort, whether it's an .06 or, in my case, a 300 Win Mag. Let the haters hate. That gun goes bang, deer usually fall down. And I'm not saying it to brag. It's just the nature of the beast. The gun works.
Nosler, so they're out of Oregon, for those that don't know. And I don't know that they're super well known here in the Midwest, which is part of the reason why we were partnering with them.
Well, and the company's been around since 1948.
Yeah, they're not new to the industry.
No.
By any stretch. And then it is a story where they started out of the garage. I believe it was John Nosler. So, you know, it's still family run business out there in Oregon. What was I going to say? So
they're not cheap. They're not your budget ammo. And so, one might say, well, OKS Hunter, what the hell? Like, you know, here's my stance on it. When it comes to ethics, I don't think, like, you, camo is expensive. We know the most expensive brand of camo is. Tree stands might be expensive. We can probably point to the most expensive tree stands, so forth. Ammunition deals in ethics. Those other things don't deal in ethics. We're dealing death here. And so we should have the utmost respect for the animal and take the best possible shot we can and use some of the best equipment. We actually use some really, like, if you want to talk about broadheads, we don't have a partner there, but like, we don't mess around with that either. So we might be okay, but we do need all the help we can get. But what we thought was kind of neat, though, is what if we took the most expensive ammo brand that we can get behind from an ethical standpoint and then also give you guys, our listeners, a nice discount to make it more affordable? To my knowledge, I don't know you're going to get this discount with anyone else, at least on the podcast realm. So you can use Active Now, code OHP at nosler.com, and you will save 20% on their ammunition.
That's pretty freaking awesome.
20% is not nothing. That's one of the heftier discounts we offer across our partners. The only other one that's that high of a discount is Spartan Forge. We won't talk about this whole entire episode. They'll get their own episode soon here so we can talk to their people, their product specialists, and really kind of break it down and talk about like what makes them unique, special, better, so forth, like how it's all done. So just more to come there, but that's the announcement. Also, before I get into the other partners like Latitude, Spartan Forge, and Rack Hub, you may have seen a post on our Instagram and our Facebook about, and even our LinkedIn, which was a ballsy move to post there, about weed and whitetails. It was an April Fool's joke. I think I've received 20 messages, at least, of people pitching me as to why they should be the host of that podcast. Some serious, some I can't tell if they're just high as they sent that note to me. I have voice memos, phone calls, and even an email or two about this post. And bold move there, Cotton, says John. Yeah, I love that line. So what I'm getting at here is we made the same April Fool's post last year, and I was like, am I really gonna do the same thing again? The difference being that this time last year we didn't really have a network. We had a couple of podcasts. I don't know if I'd be as bold to call it a network or a family podcast. Now that we do and we're growing, I'm kind of like, well, marijuana is not legal in Wisconsin in all technicality. So I can't be the host of that show. I also don't think it would be a good idea for me and my family. I can't just get down. I have a bourbon. That's enough. I can't get stoned in my studio. As much fun as that sounds, I have too much work to do and I couldn't live that life. But I'm not totally opposed to it being on the network if it's done in a good way. Like, it'd have to be done well. Like, it couldn't just be a bunch of stoners getting stoned. There's been companies that actually make food plots that have to do with hemp and deer like hemp and so forth. So we'll explore that. No guarantees or promises, but the appetite for that show is like through the roof in a way that I did not anticipate. Both from a I want to host it and I want to listen to it standpoint. Like, I'm like completely shocked. So I just wanted to address it on the show really quick because, like, I don't know. I don't know. It was just like, hey, AI, make an image of a deer with marijuana for antlers in a field full of smoke blazing up from the, and then instead of a cornfield, it's a pot field. And that image is pretty cool, to be quite frank. I told my buddy Bailey over at Serious Angler podcast, dude, you should do this post for Serious Angler for April Fools and do buds and bass. And I made an image for him with Dolly real quick. And he's like, well, shit, this is actually pretty cool. Smoke on the water with bass swimming in some marijuana underwater. Looked pretty dope, pun intended. So, anywho, we also have other partners, Latitude, Spartan Forge, Rack Hub, code OHP across the board. They'll save you some money. Spartan Forge, I think Bill was just on the IG today talking about the new Cyber Scout stuff that he's got going on. Latitude's got new stuff coming later this year. Stay frosty on that. I can't give anything away there, but like, you'll want our discount code readily available to save you some money. And Rack Hub for April Fool's did a unicorn. So I don't know if you saw that post on our story, but that was pretty funny. So I did the whole Take Me to Candy Mountain Charlie bit because that seemed to be the most fitting because they were unicorns. Anywho, those are the, I think that's all that I wanted to cover for now. Greg, do you have anything? I mean, Derek, I wish he was here because he just got back from a hog hunt in Texas. So
yeah,
good to hear
I was just in Florida. So
did you catch any sharks?
No sharks.
What?
Dude, I would have had to have probably taken bait 500 yards offshore, and it was pretty western when it came to wave action out there. It was really windy.
We talked
about it on the OKS Fisher podcast, so if people want to hear more about that, they can turn into that.
Good plug. Go check out the OKS Fisher podcast on the OKS Podcast Network. It's a good one. It is a good one. Hosted by yours truly, Mr. Tubbs here and Matt Strime. So without, I hate saying further ado, let's get our guest on. We got Alec Becker joining us this evening. Alec, you've become a good friend of not only us, but also the brand, whether that's the OKS Fisher, the OKS Hunter, and all the folks that we kind of mingle with. You've come to our event, Foam Fest. We've come to some of your stuff. You were hanging out with us at the trade show booth in the Dells. Like, you're kind of all over in a good way. Like, we appreciate you being around. But if you could just take a minute or two and introduce yourself to the audience, who are you, why you're here, and all that jazz, that'd be great.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, I'm really just a guy that's looking for any excuse to avoid my 9-to-5 job. and just so happens that I really enjoy hunting the outdoors and whatnot. And my personal ethics align quite closely with everything that you guys represent when it comes to hunting and fishing and the whole OKS brand. We'll say I'm going to be a little pissed if this Nosler ammunition ends up being better than the hand loads that I make myself. So we're going to have to see. I'm going to have to put it to the test myself.
Well, that'll be good feedback. When we have them on, you can call in and talk about how that went.
Yeah, I mean, it's a high-end premium ammunition that I haven't ponied up for yet, but I've gotten so tired of the normal off-the-shelf stuff, and especially now that I'm getting into PRS, precision rifle shooting and whatnot, I went down the rabbit hole of loading my own. So see what happens. But I'm also involved with the Wisconsin chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. So I am the vice chair for Wisconsin BHA. Joe Steffen is our fearless leader. He's also a big supporter and friend of the OKS brands. But I kind of get involved in anything and everything that BHA does all around the state. And we're gearing up right now for a nice learn to hunt turkey coming up in a couple weeks. And we do a lot of R3 and learn to hunt activities throughout the year on top of our, you know, bread and butter nonprofit advocacy for public lands, public water access, and conservation. So again, all just a distraction from my 9-to-5.
Yeah, it's good to have that. This is that for me to some degree, but I actually, unlike you, enjoy my 9-to-5 quite a bit. Nonetheless, at least, what are you, the vice chair? What is the title that you carry at BHA?
Vice chair. I'd think about it as vice president of our chapter, purely volunteer position. We in each one of the chapters across the nation are all volunteer. It's a very grassroots organization that, you know, the daily work is really done by volunteers in every state. I think we're in 48 states across the nation, but I'm just the small piece of the pie in Wisconsin.
So what is it you do with that title? Like, what are you doing? I know you do a lot and you're very busy. You also make certain things seem very easy. So, like, are you organizing events, or what does that look like for you? I'm just curious.
A little bit of everything. Of course, we have, you know, fundraising events and membership drives, trying to gain more members for Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. I'm trying to raise funds so that we can take those funds and spend them on the things that we care about. A couple examples of those would be, I mean, habitat work days. We're always working with the DNR. I know we have 3 on the calendar just for this summer around Goose Lake, kind of near Madison, actually, right in Greg's backyard. Mm-hmm. habitat cleanup days, stewardship products, trying to projects, trying to clean up the habitat, restore it to some of this native prairie that we've got in the area. And then on top of that, we do a lot of R3 events, which I'm personally very passionate about, considering I am an adult onset hunter. I'm actually a graduate of a Wisconsin DNR Learn to Hunt program. So you can thank the DNR for getting me into hunting. And now I'm returning the favor by teaching others the ways of the woods. And then policy advocacy. We're very involved in Madison, talking to state legislature, trying to get different conservation-oriented bills passed, trying to influence the right, you know, movers and shakers within the government. And I think one of our big projects for the year that I'm really focused on is landlocked public land. I know this is a very big topic out west, especially in like Wyoming, Montana. They have this checkerboard pattern of public and private land. We have some of that in Wisconsin too. It actually exists in almost every state, but we've been working with a couple different organizations to look at the data, the actual GIS data to identify landlocked public land that we as the public own, we just can't access right now. So how can we create access and make that access, you know, set in stone for perpetuity so that we can actually access the land that we as the public own and have additional opportunities to hunt, fish, recreate, however you may want to.
You and I have had conversations, you know, before getting on to this, this podcast about that. I mean, there's plenty of places locally, you know, anywhere from 200 acres to 300-400 acres that somebody bought up, but, or the state bought, but they don't have access to it. And I know for a fact that I've tried to get permission just from adjacent landowners, and they're absolutely not going to allow that.
Yeah, it's difficult, especially for adult onset hunters. You know, they typically don't have that, you know, patrilineal hunting heritage, so they don't have the family 40 or that, you know, family access to private land to hunt. So they have to default to public land. And of course, everyone's seeing it. You guys were just talking about it recently, the crowding that we see on public land. There's multiple ways to address that. The one that I most care about is creating additional access. Let's expand access to public land. And I want to start with the public land that we own currently, we just can't access. You know, let's up that utilization and provide additional acreage for people to hunt, fish, do whatever they want. Try to spread out that load on, you know, not only other hunters and anglers, but on our wildlife resources as well.
It's a good call, man. There's a piece not far from me at all that looks, I think I've shared it with Greg and Derek. I'm like, this piece looks incredible. I cannot for life me figure out how to get on it. I don't think there's a legal way without permission that I've yet to try to acquire. So it may be possible, or maybe like some have already kind of battened down those hatches or whatever. But it's not promising. Like, man, I just want to get on this piece. It looks amazing. There's not any water that runs through, so I can't like get in the canoe and get to it some other way. Like, it just isn't, it's not. So I would say, and how is that different than the MFL stuff that the DNR, or the, actually it was the Journal Sentinel blew that up. I think that was like, gosh, 2007 or 8, somewhere back then when that got reported on by a journalist, the managed forest law, where it was kind of like, yeah, I'm getting a tax credit by owning this land or allowing public recreation on it, whether hunting or otherwise, and getting a tax break, but then landlocking it and therefore not allowing there was no easement and they're still getting the tax break. So the DNR had at that point in time then developed a map which hadn't existed previously in any good way. And so they had this map application that would highlight that property And they were kind of saying, like, if you ask them, they kind of have to let you do it because they're getting the tax credit. So it's either you're going to get the tax credit and allow it, or you're not. There's also voluntary public access, which is very, very similar. Maybe it's not landlocked per se. And not to say that NMFL is all landlocked, but VPA is, you don't even have to ask if it's posted VPA. You can just go and hunt it. So kind of interesting. And I know then with the advent of Onyx and then, you know, all the others that followed, Huntstand and now Spartan Forge and so forth, like, you can see those property owner details. So it's easier to find who owns the property to call and ask. I have to imagine those property owners have been asked more than they could imagine in the advent of modern technology, where you don't have to go bust out a plat book to figure out who owns something. So are you saying there's more that exists in addition to that?
Yeah, there's a lot of different buckets. I mean, in Wisconsin, it comes down to various types of land ownership, federal, state, county, municipality, et cetera, and then layer in your managed forest land, your forest crop law, VPA, all of that. It's just a very complicated web, but federal land is a little bit different, that they don't have as many stipulations on you cannot, you know, own or purchase land that is landlocked. The state, however, does. So the state cannot acquire additional land if it doesn't have public access through what's called the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Program. That, however, is not really retroactive. That if they bought a property 5 years ago and something changed that cuts off access, that parcel still maintains ownership by the state. Nothing changes. There's also areas that, you know, we live in this age of digitization of all of these mapping apps and the access points. Not everything on paper has made its way over to the computers.
This is true. I've hunted a property that I had to find through a Sydney ordinance, and people mm-hmm. like, Eric, are you sure that's public? I'm like, yeah.
Yeah, and
but it's not out there that way, so it's interesting.
This one parcel that Greg and I have talked about offline is at the end of a road that used to extend all the way to the property, to the state-owned land, and it's bordered either side of the old road is private land that at some point the city or municipality just stopped maintaining the last stretch of that road.
Yeah, it was the township.
And it just kind of got overgrown and absorbed into this private land. So if you look at it technically, there may still be access from a legal standpoint that, you know, this used to be a road, this used to be a right of way for the public to access this property. But reality has set in over the last 5, 10, 15 years that it's just become part of the private land. So there could be an avenue, you know, for this specific parcel to go do the dirty, heavy lifting of going down to the county clerk, digging up those dusty, you know, survey reports and figuring out what is the actual easement or land access zone to get to this parcel. Or it could be a conversation with the landowners. I know that, Greg, you know, these landowners aren't necessarily jumping to allow public access, because also through my Googling, I found that there was a there was human remains found a few years ago at this former access site.
What?
And talking to the DNR, you know, the DNR was like, yeah, there seems to be some conflict with the landowners when it comes to public access.
Oh,
like,
yeah. Not?
No shit. They found a dead body. Like, yeah,
It made news. Yeah, it made news. And I remember there was a specific case it was linked to, and it was pretty crazy.
And all of this being said, like, rightfully so, you know, rightfully so, there's conflict and we want to respect private land ownership, property rights. There's under no means do we want to strong arm a private landowner and saying, you must give me access. No, I want to use the carrot, not the stick. And you know, some of these things that you mentioned, VPA, great example. VPA has a flat payment based on what your property has in terms of habitat. That may not be enough for a landowner to consider, you know, giving public access. So that's where BHA, as a non-governmental organization, we can come in and say, I'll sweeten that deal. I'll incentivize you to open access. And, you know, the other side of the coin, we can have those fights that the state, you know, can't touch. We can play in a lot of different spaces that the state, because of their, you know, government mandates and whatnot, can't get involved with.
That's fascinating. And you guys have, I mean, speaking to BHA and the Wisconsin chapter, you guys have like policymakers on, like it's volunteer or on staff or whatever the nomenclature is there. But like those guys sit in the same offices as the politicians,
mm-hmm.
or the same, you know, corridors, and can go down the hall and knock, hey, Steve, can you take a look at this? Or, you know, I don't know how it actually works because I'm not in that realm at all. But I remember at one of the events you guys had, I think a Learn to Hunt event was happening there. I think Quinn was cutting up and quartering a deer not too far from our conversation as we found our way into the cooler. But I remember hearing like the policymakers talking. I was like, man, that's a totally different world, you know, one that I know very little about. And I think a lot of us in the hunting community can have strong disposition and opinions and visceral responses. But to the guys that are actually, the guys and gals that are in the weeds doing some of the stuff, like it's work, you know, it's relationships over time. And I like to hear the narrative you're talking about, like, let's add more access. I don't think anyone would argue with that, regardless of where you stand, whether you're a Matt Ranella or the antithesis of that. Hearing more land that can be accessed that we already own that we aren't accessing, there's no who would argue against that. I don't know.
Yeah, and that, I mean, R3 is a passion of mine, and maybe I'm biased. Absolutely, I'm biased because I was a student of a Learn to Hunt program, and I hunt exclusively public land. So I want to evangelize people to do the same as me. I get it. But when I look at, you know, this anti-R3 movement, saying we should not recruit more hunters, we should not teach people how to hunt, I view it as, one, either misguided and, you know, they're making connections that don't exist, or it's rooted in selfishness, that I don't want other people hunting the spots that I'm hunting. And I hunt public land in one of the most populated counties in Wisconsin. You're fine. I promise you, you're fine. You can find a spot to hunt and not have it screw up your hunt because there's another hunter a mile from you. I also see this argument against R3 as contradictory to our North American model of wildlife conservation, that people arguing against recruitment, retention, and reactivation are looking at this wildlife and hunting opportunity and saying, this is mine. This hunting opportunity is mine. This public land, which is owned by everybody, is only there for me. And these wildlife resources, the deer, elk, whatever it may be, I should be the only one having access to that. That idea is something that I vehemently oppose. And I'm doing my work through R3 to fight that. I mean, got some good data, if you guys want to go through data, in terms of why I think R3 is a good investment for any hunter and angler, but specifically why I and BHA am focusing on it. You want me to dive down the rabbit hole?
I'm not opposed.
Hit the high fast ones, if nothing else.
So I'm just speaking for myself, the R3, the Learn to Hunt programs that I have personally done Now, across the state in BHA, we have multiple other guys, specifically Tony Cordero. He is our R3 coordinator for BHA. He's putting on events all over the state as well. But over the last 2 years, I have put on Learn to Hunt Turkey, Deer, and Pheasant, and I have entertained 50 students over these 2 years. 20% of those students they repeat Learn to Hunt events. So if they did pheasant, they're going to come back and do deer or turkey or whatever. They're coming back to learn more, to sharpen their skills more. And by the way, these are all adult hunters. They're all adults looking to get into hunting, public land specifically. 25% of my students come back to work days for BHA. So they're also helping clean up our public lands. They're helping improve the habitat. And 5 of those students have now become mentors for future Learn to Hunt programs. So they're immediately giving back to this R3 movement. I've got some phenomenal mentors as well. Specific shout out to Jason Gonzalez. He has mentored at every single one of my Learn to Hunt events over the last almost 3 years now. But then if you think about this argument of R3 is just a mechanism for, you know, gun companies to attract more consumers and make more money. All right, fine, maybe. But we also have to think about what does that do for conservation and what does that do for hunting and fishing broadly in our North American model of wildlife conservation, specifically through Pittman Robertson. Rough math, these 50 students that I've, you know, some capacity mentored over the last 2 years have put about $7,000 back into conservation in Wisconsin over these 2 years. I think that's a pretty good return on investment for my time. The state of Wisconsin now has $7,000 more to better habitat, better wildlife, and all of those good things in the state because of these 50 students that went onto a DNR website and said, I want to learn how to hunt. I'm going to go hit and roll in this class. And here they are.
If you're looking for an authentically gritty podcast about the lost art of trapping and the woodsmanship that goes into it, check out the OKS Trapper podcast on the OKS Podcast Network, hosted by Zach Hansen, the author of Turning Feral, A Modern Journey of Hunting, Trapping, and Living Intentionally in the Wilderness. You can find it on Spotify by searching OKS Trapper or by visiting OKSHunter.com and looking at our podcast network lineup.
So that's my little rant in terms of why R3.
Did you happen to read, did Pat Durkin just write an article on the decline in hunter numbers?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's real. I mean,
people that don't believe that though. And so, as OKS Hunter becomes more of a media company and we're putting out more editorial content, we're getting access to some analytical reports and statistics and studies from the DNR, the same studies he got access to. They're not done, but I'm looking at the report right now and I don't think I can actually speak to it. Because I've not had enough time to familiarize myself, but I know that's the same report because we asked, hey, what report did Pat Durkin reference here? Because it wasn't linked to or referenced. It was talked about. And so we got the study because we asked, because like the DNR is a public entity funded by taxpayers. We have access as that. We can request that stuff, of course, as a public population. And so there's more interesting stats in there about like, you know, baby boomers are aging out and so forth. But it's also like, I don't know. Maybe we're competing with much like and I always tie things back to business, but much like a brand might think, oh, well, what are my competitors doing on social media that I can do to separate myself on a paid ad campaign? Well, you don't have to worry about your competitors as much. You have to worry about everything. You're competing with everything. You're competing with the post from Aunt Susie about her 2-year-old. You're competing with the the posts about the holidays or the politicians. You're competing with other companies advertising for share a wallet across all spectrums. Like, you're competing against everything. As hunters, like, people that are looking for share of whatever it is, I don't know what the word I'm looking for here is, but like, if R3 were to get more hunters, like, you're competing with, I want to watch March Madness instead of go shoot my bow. I want to watch football more than I want to wake up early. I want to go fishing or do some other outdoor activity. You're competing against everything. And so, yeah, people might be aging out. It might be hard to get kids involved, but there's also other things that the hunting industry is competing with that we're losing to. And some of the projections I see, like by 2040, which is, you know, in less than 20 years from now, it's not looking good. Like, it's looking about as bad as it can look. And so I find I like the way you approach things with the statistics, and you're like, you have anecdotes coming from it as an adult hunter that came to it as an adult. I did too, and I didn't have any of those. I did come from like a paternal, you talk about like the paternal side of it. My dad introduced me to it, albeit I got into it as like a late teen, as a gun hunter, didn't really care about it because I cared about, you know, things high schoolers care about, like saying hi to girls and getting phone numbers and all that stuff. And it wasn't until later when I was like, yeah, I want to pick up a bow or what. I think I actually asked my dad for a gift card to a rock climbing place, and he didn't give me a gift card to a rock climbing place. He gave me a gift card to an archery shop, and he gave me his old bow, and he's like, I'm buying a new bow. You can have my old one. Here's some money to the shop to get that bow outfitted. And I was like, man, I wanted to go rock climbing. Like, what am I going to do with this? Turned out to be the best gift he ever gave me. So he knew better than I did at the time what was a better gift for his young boy. I don't know where I'm going with that other than continue on. Greg, I don't know if you have input or thoughts. You've been a woodsman your whole life, so you're not by definition an adult onset hunter.
No, just by default, it was that or sit at home, and I didn't really like sitting at home. I wasn't into video games like my brother was, so I preferred to be out hunting or, you know, riding my bike someplace to go fishing or whatever. It kept me out of trouble, or maybe it got me into trouble. I don't know.
Stealth Flew, John, who we know, commented, said hunter numbers are declining based on population growing. So whether or not you believe hunter numbers are declining, whatever data points you look at, the population is growing at a pace, and that pace is creating a gap between the people that hunt and the people that don't. So the population growth, to John's point, is outpacing the recruitment of hunters against that population of human beings in this country. So there's just more people that they're not against it. They just don't hunt. There's just more non-hunters than hunters. And then you have your antis. I don't know what the anti numbers look like. I'm actually curious to what that is, but
it could be a skewed number. You know, it could be a pretty skewed number because
it's probably a small percentage that are just.
Antis might even fall into non-hunters, and, you know, people might answer that questionnaire twice. You don't know.
An article we've talked about, Eric, that I think Durkin wrote a piece on it as well, but believe there was an Outdoor News or Outdoor Life article about the public perception of hunting has had its first like decline in a number of years. And whether that's anti-hunters or people that are just ambivalent about hunting, all of that affects what happens at the ballot box. And unfortunately, we're seeing a lot of decisions being made these days that affect our wildlife and our hunting opportunities. It's all being done at the ballot box.
It always gets dug in by the politicians.
Yeah, the fewer people that approve and support of hunting there are, the more likely we are to see our rights and abilities and access get restricted year over year. And, you know, go look at Colorado right now. They're facing referendums, you know. Let's not even talk about the wolf reintroduction. Let's talk about what's still to come. They're looking at having, you know, lion hunting banned, mountain lion hunting banned with the use of dogs. And there's even language that kind of opens the door for banning any kind of hunting dog, upland included. So we're already facing the decline in public support for hunting, starting to affect our ability to get out there. And I think it'll, you know, in 2040, like you said, if we have so many fewer hunters and fewer hunting opportunity, what's that going to look like from a biology standpoint? Because one of our only tools to manage populations and healthy ecosystems is hunting. So the ramifications of losing hunting support are way broader than just my ability to go down the street and shoot a whitetail.
That's probably a better narrative for politicians to grasp onto, to speak to that. It's such a hard thing for people to understand. We talked about I can't think of the damn word now, but we had the OKS cook on a week or two ago. We talked about, you know, this giving cute creatures a voice. I forget what that's called. It's called something. Anthropomorphization.
Anthropomorphization.
Thank you. That's a really tough one for me, apparently. But, you know, we talk about, you can't hunt with dogs. Even as a hunter, I didn't understand the whole let's hunt with dogs. It wasn't until we had the Houndsman XP on, Chris Powell, who like said, well, if we tree a bear with dogs, I can identify the sex of that bear. I can determine if it's a bear worth shooting or not. And oftentimes we'll just let it go because it's not the bear we're after.
It's almost like catch and release fishing, really.
So the person that isn't a hunter won't even entertain that conversation because they're like, I can't believe you're sending dogs after a mountain lion. Because like, if you're a non-hunter, Your opinion would be a mountain lion would eat a dog. What are you talking about? A mountain lion would F up a dog any day of the week, but not the way that it works with these dogs. They tree the cat, you identify the cat, and you decide if you're going to shoot the cat or not. And if it's a juvenile cat,
or maybe female, you don't shoot
it. A female, that's like, then you walk away from it and you go on. Like, you've actually done that animal a service or a favor to some degree in the name of like wildlife biology because you're using dogs. All I'm saying is there's no way someone that doesn't have any concept of hunting is even, they see that a ballot box and they're like, yep, that's a hard no for me, dog. I'm not sending dogs in the woods to chase, you know, predators. Are you out of your mind? They don't even begin to comprehend what that looks like or why that's a benefit to the animal that we're hunting. They don't get it.
Yeah, we'd much rather have these, you know, Great Pyrenees, big floofy dogs sitting in our living room and not, you know, filling their natural biological imperative that they were bred to do, which is fight coyotes to the death to protect their flock of sheep or whatever, you know, animal it is. I think there's also this whole aspect of my retrievers. I don't think they know what birds are. They just love the game of retrieving. And, you know, hunting is just a really complicated game of fetch for them. But these dogs are bred for this purpose of hunting. And I'm actually doing them a disservice by not hunting them. So, like I said, you want to see what the ramifications are of losing hunting access? Well, it's not just going to be Greg, Alec, and Eric losing the access, you know, down the road to shoot a whitetail. You're going to have GSPs bouncing off the walls because no one's taking them out to hunt.
That's a good point. And hunting overarches far more than the, you know, wily whitetail that I like to chase. It's the upland. It's the waterfowl. It's Derek was just in Texas hunting hogs. He just said he's got a whole new lens on hunting with dogs because those dogs.
And guys who hunt with dogs, that's their livelihood. Like a professional bass fisherman, tournament fishing for bass is their livelihood. It may not make as much money and it may not make a whole lot of sense to a lot of people, but don't mess with people's livelihood.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a whole ecosystem of guides and outfitters, and you know, there's a lot of commerce in hunting, but to put it into perspective, like, I think the, I don't know, like, what's the shoe industry? You know, $85 billion in revenue per year. What's the hunting industry? 20, 26, 25? It's like considerably smaller than another industry. And no one's trying to take shoes away from people. Like,
right.
I don't know. I say that to say, I had a different point I was going to make about the size of the industry from a revenue standpoint. And just to add some perspective to how small we really are in contrast to all other types of commerce. So we talk about like, R3 is just trying to recruit people to make money. To a point, even if they are, we're a blip on the radar in contrast to other industries, other largely commercialized industries that don't have ethics involved in them. Like, it's very, very different. It's very different. I think I mentioned on a different episode, like, no one's trying to take surfing away. No one's trying to take golf away. No one's trying to take mountain biking away. Like, these are other subsets and small niches that exist that you can go leisurely do and recreate all day long till the cows come home. No one's, golf's not at the ballot box. Surfing's not at the ballot box. Like, none of these other things are being taken away from us actively, but hunting is. And hunting is a considerably smaller industry than most other industries. So, like, I think we kind of do need more hunters to a certain degree, especially if we're on the decline. If numbers are truly going down, which they seem to be, if you look at the reports and the Pat Durkin thing, those are just small sample sets of examples of data that you could look to. There are others out there. I feel like I'm having an argument with Matt Rinnell right now, and he's not on the podcast. I don't know that I fully comprehend. I get the commercialization of it, and that's bad, and influencers aren't great. Now I'm on my soapbox, Alec, to the post I put out last week. Like, why are we blaming the hunting public for crowding an area? Why don't we look at the people that are crowding the area, the ones that are scrutinizing every picture? That same thing happens in fishing. It's like, ooh, I recognize that house in the background. I'm going to go fish your spot. Why would you do that? Why would you go crowd someone else's spot? Like, that, I think there's more of a problem with the human that does that than the people that are doing it. Like, that's no different than if the local townie bar has someone bragging about a big buck they got on camera. Like, if that guy has influence, people might go crowd his spot. He might not be hunting public influence, but he has influence in his own community and still create the same problem. But the problem isn't him. The problem is the other people that are, I think, you know, crowding that area by trying to find a shortcut. And the ones that are trying to find a shortcut are likely not doing it for the right reasons, which maybe gets me on board with Matt Rinella's disposition a little bit, insofar as there probably are influencers that are doing things for the wrong reasons to some degree.
But who's going to show them the right way? That's where I think you guys.
Yes.
But everybody has a different interpretation of the right way. We know people like that in the industry.
There's a lot of ways, and it might not always be pure and beautiful and so forth. But, you know, if it gets them outdoors and they're not breaking like laws and ethics, but some of them are. And that's where the problem starts to happen. The problem where it's like it's overcrowding my area. To Greg's point, Greg hunts a deep, deep tamarack swamp. It's disgusting. You can get turned around, lost, fall into sinkholes. It's not pretty. You can sumac poisoning or whatever the hell it's called. Like, there's not a time that guy walks in that swamp, he doesn't come out and beat the shit out of in some way, shape, or form, or just soaking wet. And there's not a spot in there that hasn't been already boot tracked by some other hunter. There's not a spot he can go to that feels like it's off the grid that doesn't have a cell cam. Like, I'm sorry to say, but your spot isn't sacred. Everyone knows about it now because everyone's hunting in unique ways now. Like, the democratization of land access through apps like Onyx and Spartan Forge and others, and finding these areas and digital e-scouting and all the YouTubers that exist, like, there's a strong appetite to get better and to learn. And that has happened over time where the people that have been in it, like, the land isn't, where am I going with this? What I'm trying to say is, like, it isn't just the hunting public as the exemplar I'm using here. It isn't just Rinella. It's a combination of all sorts of things. So your approach of, like, let's just get more land access would help as a relief valve, spread that population out more of hunters so it wouldn't feel as crowded. But public land, in my opinion, has been crowded since the day I set foot on it. 20 plus years ago, it was just as crowded up north. I remember hearing a guy cough and clear in his throat. My first sit in the woods ever in the Nicolay National Forest. Driving around trying to find parking spots where there's not already 10 trucks. And going down logging roads thinking you're in the newest, bestest spot. And you weren't. Someone else already beat you to it. Like, that's been the narrative for me since day one. So this isn't new to me. It doesn't feel any different than it's ever felt. That's my thought.
But that's, yeah, I mean,
it's POV.
Go look at the Wisconsin Rut Report. Every bow season, you see county after county, public land giants. I myself got a beautiful buck on, you know, public land very close to a large urban center. In the grand scheme of things, there were six other trucks parked next to me. does not affect my ability to kill a really nice deer or to fill my freezer or whatever means, you know, I want to get out of hunting. The addition of people on that public land has made me a better hunter, and it has not harmed my hunting experience whatsoever. And if this crowding of public land was truly causing, you know, a population level impact or a biological impact for the ecosystem, you would not be seeing, you know, Ozaukee County private or public, you know, Walworth County public. You would not be seeing these big deer coming off of public land every year in Wisconsin. It's just proof positive that there is still opportunity out there. You just got to be a good hunter to find it.
What's interesting is that they call out, like, you have to call out the county. So let's talk about, I don't like people showing where you got a deer. Even though they're not showing the specific latitude, longitude, like, they are calling out the county. Like, if you know that person, which people in that county probably do, there's somebody that would know that person. You could probably put two and two together and get four. It wouldn't be terribly difficult. I just am never the person that's going to put two and two. I don't care. Like, I'm not going to go, ooh, that's where it was killed. I'm going to go hunt that spot. There's too many variables in play. Like, what was in crop? What was the crop that year? Was it beans? Was it corn? Was it, were the acorns dropping? Were they not dropping? When did he get it? Early season, mid season, late season rut? Like, there's no way you're going to have the same spot and get the same result. You're an entirely different human being and hunter than the other person. There's all these other circumstances, weather, barometric pressure, so forth, does coming through, that the spot to me is agnostic. To a degree, I think historically will show you, like, historic rubs will show you where bucks will frequent, how they may traverse the terrain. And but that's going to be common regardless. There's pinch points. We all know how to look for that stuff as hunters. But this whole, let me go kill something or hunt an area where someone else killed something, is just, I can't understand it because I'm not that person. So the people that do that, I take problem with them because they're the bad eggs ruining it for the rest of us. And the rut report's a good example of that. Like, it's not just these influencers, it's sites like that too. If you're going to get on board with that argument, there are other things. I won't get on board with the argument because I would agree that I'm more philosophical in my approach. That's why one of my favorite quotes is, you can't change the direction of the wind, but you can adjust your sails. So if you're having a problem with public land, you can say, like, I don't have to hunt public land. I get to hunt public land. I don't have to go to work. I get to go to work. Like, I don't have to do the dishes. I get to do dishes. I have a dishwasher. So I get to do these things. I don't have to compete with other hunters. I get to compete with them. And that, your spin on it mentally is your biggest tool in your toolbox that you could ever deploy. And I know it sounds cheesy and stupid, like, okay, Eric, you go hunt a property with 100 other people inside of, you know, 80 acres. All right, I get to do that. Cool. Like, I get to go do that. I get to go have that experience. Maybe I'll meet my next best friend there because we're both okay as hunters and we both whiffed at the same buck. I don't know. Like, I have a tendency to always deploy a positive outlook on things. Optimism is my best friend. Like, I enjoy that perspective because negative energy just doesn't have any great outcomes in life across many things, especially hunting. Like, that was a terrible hunt. Bullshit. I've never had a bad hunt. Like, in the grand scheme of things, every hunt's a great hunt. It's a hunt. That's the best thing. Like, what is the saying? A bad day at work, or what is it? A bad hunt's better than any day at work, and then a good day at work. How does it go?
A bad day of hunting is better than any good day at work.
Right. So, like, it's relative. So, of course, things can go wrong. We can have blunders, but I don't even know where we're going. We're just soapboxing the shit out of this thing right now. Alec, talk about learn to hunt. What's coming up, man? What are we teaching people here?
We got to learn to hunt turkey coming up in a couple weeks. Greg and Matt are going to be helping out a little bit with that. Help me out with some scouting. And Matt is going to be talking to us about turkey calls this weekend, actually. I have one of my Weathered Oaks game calls sitting right here.
That's nice.
Yeah, we're going to be teaching some students how to hunt turkeys. We've got, I don't know, 8 students in my Learn Hunt Turkey, but Tony with BHA is going to be doing one in the Driftless region in partnership with Brock from the National Deer Association. There's multiple Learn to Hunt Turkeys going on this April all across the state. But let's see if we can convince some new hunters that these thunder chickens are worth chasing every year. And then hopefully I'll actually be able to get some hunting in myself when it comes time for season.
It's only going to take one encounter with a bird goblin and coming strutting right to the decoy spread, or just seeing one, I think, within earshot to get him convinced that it's fun.
I mean, my first...
Don't even start, Eric.
So I think my first turkey hunt was probably pretty similar to yours, Eric, that I, you know, when I was young and didn't have as many obligations, specifically financial obligations, my first turkey hunt was with guides. Some guides that I had gone hunting with a few times for waterfowl. I was like, you know what? Let's try turkey. Within 15 minutes of my first day turkey hunting, I had a giant tom dead on the ground. I was like, oh shit, this is easy. Like, what? Why is the season a week long? You know, you can get this done in a day. But that was private land on birds that hadn't been hunted. I had it made. Then going out to public land, trying to get a bird myself, you learn real quick that these birds are a lot smarter than you think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a feeling that if I were to do it on my own, I would have zero luck. And I'm willing to roll those dice to see how that goes. But I have literally no clue how to hunt a turkey. I actually, speaking of public land, I couldn't tell you where I would even begin. Like, I would just go out there and probably start thinking about deer again and be like, oh, I didn't see any turkeys, but I found some good deer sign. Like, I would just be scouting for deer hunting more than likely.
Honestly, I can tell you, like, if you can just do some driving around, like right now, start doing some driving around, because this is the beginning of the season, you're going to see where birds are.
Yeah, but that's in cornfield, dude. I can't
Would you let me finish?
Yeah, I will. I'm sorry.
You're cutting me off, you freight train. Go out, do some driving, do some scouting, look for some birds, do some door knocking, use your app, find out who owns those properties. You would be amazed at how much easier it is to get permission on a piece of private, even if it's only a 20-some acre parcel. They've got birds there early in the mornings, you know, right at first light. If you have that ability, those birds are not roosting very far away from there. Go do some researching and knock on some doors. People usually don't have a problem with shooting turkeys. Deer is a totally different game. But I've gotten permission on lots of places. You know, my pieces of public didn't work out. Yeah, you can hunt for the next 2 days. Great. So I got to try and make it happen in 2 days. Sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't. But it got me in the game if my other pieces weren't looking so hot. If
they weren't holding it.
Sure.
All right.
Yeah.
And like you said, Eric, if you don't get a bird, it's still better than a good day at work.
Well, the thing about turkey hunting is I'm probably going to go to work that same day, but you know.
Even better, you can get both done in one day. You can hunt and go to work. I see no reason to not turkey hunt.
It was pretty cool going with Greg and Matt, though, having them do all the legwork and so forth. It was nice to have them there with me because I hadn't done it before. I wouldn't really know what to do with the bird. I would probably still struggle with that this year. And although I may have some sharper knives, I would say we had a bird down by like 6:15, 6:20 in the morning. I was like, whoa, this is way different than deer hunting. I have a dead bird. It's not even 7 a.m. Like, I could totally do this before I go to work, you know? It's actually pretty cool. And I really enjoyed being in the woods in the spring, hearing all the birds and the greenery. I definitely want to... I did spray the shit out of my clothes with permethrin, or whatever it's called, because I was very nervous about ticks. Because they're everywhere. But I didn't have a problem with them. Yep. Yeah. No, it's good stuff. So the Learn Hunt it's like a DNR program that you help facilitate, or is it a BHA program? Like, how does that? You guys do more than just turkey.
Yeah. So all of these programs we host as the organization is BHA, but we apply for authorization with the DNR. So. Example being this Learn to Hunt Turkey, we're going to be doing adult students they're going to be hunting during youth season, which is a week before our opening week of turkey in Wisconsin. That we do that during youth season because there's already going to be people out in the woods that are hunting turkeys. We also want these students to learn how to hunt public land and not just have this, you know, free guided hunt or whatever. But it's all under, call it, supervision of the DNR. They're giving us harvest authorizations. And we actually ask students buy a turkey tag so that you can go hunt yourself after this class. You know, we're going to give you the keys to the car, now go drive. But it's all in partnership with the DNR. And all of these students, regardless of turkey, deer, pheasant, whatever, they're signing up through the DNR. So we're not going out to REI and being like, hey, you want to shoot a bird?
That wouldn't work.
You know, we're tapping into people that are looking to learn how to do this. And our classes, actually, we did not even advertise. We don't advertise any of our classes. There are people sitting on the DNR website, hitting refresh every day, looking for these Learn to Hunt programs, and they fill up within a day or two. So there's a lot of people that have this appetite to learn. And I'm just a guy that's going to go send people out into the woods with guns.
Sweet. Hope for the best. You know, have these people already completed hunter safety then, though, to that point?
Yes, I require hunter safety and hunting licenses for all of the students. There are waivers for all of this stuff when it comes to the DNR. Like, the DNR can give you a waiver to hunt without a license for certain species. I don't really want to get involved in that. I want people to have demonstrated they're going to be safe and understand how to be safe with firearms and weapons. And, you know, have also put in that investment to become hunters. They just want somebody to show them how to hunt on public land specifically. Yeah. So, you know, again, I'm not going to REI with a clipboard saying sign here for hunter safety. I'm showing people how to navigate public land and respect other hunters while they're out there.
Good message, man. So the way to sign up or to learn about these Learn to Hunts is through the DNR site, just to be clear.
Yeah. The DNR, through the Go Wild system, has a whole sign up page that you can look at. I think if you just Google Learn to Hunt programs or R3 programs for Wisconsin or whatever state you may be in, they're going to have links to whatever you're going to need. The DNR has paid people to coordinate these things when they work with groups like mine, specifically for adults. We focus on adults. There are groups for children. Our good friend Quinn, he works for an organization that is dedicated to mentoring children looking to get into hunting and don't have that, you know, an adult in their life that is teaching them the ways of hunting. So there's tons of organizations and opportunities out there, not only for people looking to get into hunting, but also for people to help out and do a little mentoring. It's a lot of fun.
Greg has done a bunch of mentoring.
I wouldn't say it's a bunch, but I've done a couple things and I enjoyed it. It was very rewarding to see somebody have some success. And it was just great. Even if we didn't succeed, it was still nice to be there and have conversations and feel like you're being helpful.
You're a good mentor to me, man. You've been a good mentor to a lot, even just by being a host on this podcast. You've been a bit of a mentor to folks. Love hearing your voice on the show, Greg.
Thanks.
Yeah. Robert Budworth commented, said, I would probably love turkey hunting. I think I will over time.
If you put the work in and you start to see some results, it's hard not to love turkey hunting.
Yeah, it's cool.
There's nothing else in Wisconsin that screams in your face like a turkey gobbling in the spring.
We have elk, but it's not very huntable yet.
Yeah, unless you're one of the lucky four.
Right. Yeah, four. Exactly. Man, I'm yawning. I'm tired. I had another thought. Al, you got a nice buck last year on public. What bow were you shooting, by the way? I was just curious.
I was shooting a Matthews. I didn't know shit about bows, and I went into a bow shop that I'll never go to again, but they set me up with this Matthews, and I was terrible at archery. Absolutely awful. I kind of stumbled into like getting some good equipment, like a Matthews, you know, a good rest, drop away rest, sight housing, all of that stuff. But I was terrible at shooting. What was it, 2022? I sent an arrow through the back strap of, you know, a little 6-point buck, and kind of swore to myself, like, I'm starting from ground zero. I'm going to reinvest my whole shooting setup in terms of archery form. And I actually found a guy local to me in the Brookfield area that was an archery coach, and now he just runs a shop like 3 days a week on his own. But I started from zero, working on my form, getting lessons from this archery coach. And all of that led up to me hunting this spot that actually, I will say, Quinn found and sent me the pin. He found it during one of my learn to hunts. So,
and Greg do to me, they send me pins.
Yeah. Quinn sent me the pin. He found it while he was, you know, operating under my supervision, but he still does get the credit for this spot. Hunting this spot, this giant buck comes in, also 10 minutes after I had shot a doe. You know, don't shoot does during the rut. No, I am always shooting does during the rut now. Anyway, this buck comes in, I see antlers, I black out. I could not tell you what this buck's rack looked like. I just saw antlers, completely blacked out. But the one thing I remember was drawing and setting into my anchor point and remembering all of my, like, you know, checklist items of, all right, make sure your shoulders feel good. Is your grip right? You know, ease through that release. All of that, like, work and preparation ended up me reverting back to that just fundamentals of archery shooting and archery form. And that is why I was able to take a quartering two shot and slip the arrow right through the heart from the top corner to the bottom corner of the heart. And I could not have done that if I didn't take the time to invest in the ethics of my archery shooting, you know, because I had that experience. I wounded a deer and I felt awful about it, but I put in the time and it worked and it paid off.
It's good to hear, man. Not a lot of people would go through that trouble to start from zero again. It's a hard place to start from. I would compare it to prestiging in the game of Call of Duty. Like, why would I start from zero again if I can just stay here with all this best shit? But well, by prestiging, you have to go through it all again from zero, and you get better because there's more time in. And so it does work out in your favor to prestige as a bow hunter.
I did almost have a kill streak going that day because I killed two deer that day. I killed a nice, like, 65-pound yearling doe, and then I killed this buck. And I think if I think back to the start of the morning, in true okayest hunter fashion, I was in my tree all set up about 20 minutes after shooting light. And climbing up that tree was like, is this the first time I'm ever climbing up a tree? Something was just like off that day. And I was fumbling all over, almost fell out of the tree. And when the first doe came in, I drew back, and I just switched last year to a thumb button release. And I drew back, and my thumb button hit the collar on my jacket. Thunk, shot right into the dirt. So I did shoot three arrows that day. So yeah, that could have been a kill streak, and I could have, what is it, a UAV you get when
UAV. Yeah, exactly. Boy, yeah. I'd give it a go, be able to play some freaking video games. This is not my life. For the record, both bucks I got had nothing to do with pins from Derek or Greg. Fortunately or unfortunately, I'm not sure. So apparently I can figure it out on my own, so maybe there's hope for me in the turkey woods. But I also had lots of OKS bullshit happening on both of those kills. Very similar to your story. I had one hell of a time getting into the tree, to the tune of like, I was like, there's no freaking deer around anymore. They're gone. But I think a hot doe came through and got them all riled up. So erased their memory of whatever the hell noise I was making trying to get set up on the bigger guy I got. So that was pretty cool. I was curious about your bow. I realized I didn't mention anything about Bear Archery being a partner earlier in the show, but I'm waiting for Greg to get his bow so we can go to the shop to get all tuned up. And yeah, I just got an update yesterday, Greg. I'll tell you offline. We might have to. There's a lot of bows that are just on back order right now. And so whether or not the one you are getting is the one to stick with or a different one, I'm not actually sure yet.
Or I just shoot what I got.
No, that's true. But I want to have the opportunity to go do this with you because I want you as my mentor to go through this stuff. So I could just go do it on my own, but I enjoy our time together, Greg. And I think that'll be a good use of our time spent together in an archery shop, flinging arrows and getting everything all tuned up. So, you know, as far as the bear stuff goes, there'll be a lot more to come as the year progresses and we get closer to season and we actually got stuff set up. I had someone ask me today what kind of bow I shoot, but to be frank, I've never killed a deer with my dad's Dart and Viper that he had given to me. I had it for some time, and then eventually I got a Bear Empire, which is a single cam bow. And that's what I killed all my deer with. Last year I got the Legend XR, and now I got the Persist. And my appetite to go shoot this bow is very great. So I'm more impatient about your bow than you are, probably. I really want to go shoot this thing. I'm like chomping at the absolute bit to go shoot it. I couldn't be more enthused. I'm curious to know if I'll like it more than the Legend. But I did sell my Empire to Jace, our videographer and producer. So he's got that bow now. The Empire strikes back, and he has it. He restrung it, as you had recommended, Greg, that I should have done years ago, but didn't. And I got that new peep sight on there, all that jazz. So hopefully it's in good hands with Jace, and he has some luck with it. It's a very nice bow. It's an older bow, but it's smooth and quiet, and smooth and quiet is deadly in my opinion. So, but the Persist looks sexy AF sitting in the studio, and I'm just dying to shoot it. So anywho, that's my two cents there. I wanted to make sure I didn't do any disservice to the people that have chosen to partner with us. But we do have four of those bows we're going to be giving away this year. So whether or not we find some fun ways to partner with BHA, Foam Fest, other ways to go to market with that, I think how it'll end up working is we'll give two away at Foam Fest like we've done in the past, and then two away in other ways previous to that or prior to that, or maybe even mid-season. But speaking of Foam Fest, by the way, I have added our event to the calendar at the Horican Bowman for the last Saturday of August. It's the same weekend as Labor Day weekend. So tentatively, I've got it pinned on the calendar. I have to go to some board meetings to just get full buy-in. So I don't want to get the event page created with registration, sign up, and so forth until I have the full buy-in of the board. So unfortunately, they're meeting right now on a Tuesday. So it's hard for me to find time to get there to figure that out. I'm trying to figure out when I can make that work. In the past, I think I've moved the podcast up, done it, disconnected, drove the 45 minutes or hour to where it's at, done the board meeting, and then got that affirmation. So I'm hopeful that I could go about it a little bit differently this year, because that's a lot in any given day, considering my days start early. And on Tuesdays, they go very, very long, as you, I mean, you guys all had busy days too. So here you are. You understand. That's what I got. I just want to make sure I covered off on that. That's the other thing I want to talk about, is Foam Fest and Bear Archery. And so as we come to a close, I was like, oh yeah, do your job, Eric. Talk about the stuff that you're supposed to talk about.
We've had people ask about when Foam Fest is. When's it going to be?
Lots of people. Yeah.
Lots of people. people. So they're trying to put it in their calendar so they know.
Yeah. Maybe not as many people as inquired about weed and whitetails, but certainly it's up there.
I'm counting down the days to Foam Fest. You know, someone's got to show Greg that all this heavy arrow stuff is a bunch of BS.
Oh, so. Right.
Different strokes for different folks, guys. But you know, we're all playing the same game and having fun doing it. So it's all good. That's it. That is an entirely different topic. So, yeah. Anyway, thanks guys for hanging out tonight, Alec. Appreciate you being a guest. Is there anywhere you want to point people to go? Like, should they go to? How do they sign up for BHA Wisconsin or other chapters? What does that look like?
Backcountryhunters.org. There should be a map. Find your state, click on the map, and that'll get you where you need to go.
What do you get as a member? What am I going to expect as a member?
There are a bunch of cool discounts. Too many for me to list off right now. There are some nice discounts that I use frequently. You also get a nice magazine from BHA talking about everything that's going on around the country. Most importantly, you'll get to meet some really cool people.
Like you?
I think not like me. No. I met cool people like Eric and Greg.
Oh, boy.
Basically through BHA.
Yeah.
Your standards are pretty low when it comes to me, but thank you for that compliment.
Yeah, we can't take compliments here. We won't take them. Send it back.
I'm quite all right if you stipulate signing up for BHA saying, keep Alec away from me. Peace. You know, let people... avoid me as much as I want to avoid hearing myself talk.
To your point, though, you attend a pint night or a rendezvous or any type of event with BHA, you're meeting up with like-minded people that have a passion for this and taking care of the public lands and cleaning up the environment. It's a good thing.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, part of what we do with our 1% of time from the 2% for conservation stuff that we donate to, 1% of our revenue goes to them and 1% of our time, 1% of your time. I forget how they calculate that based on how many people are in your organization and what a year looks like. But we partner heavily with Waukesha County Land Conservancy. And so it's another great organization here. If you're anyone from Wisconsin listening, just kind of, this is a very Wisconsin centric episode, I suppose, which is fine. Cause that's where we're from. But not every episode. We haven't done like a very Wisconsin-centric episode in quite some time. Although I think we have some coming up. We got some DNR wardens that'll be coming into studio to talk about the day in the life of a warden, which sounds pretty interesting. I'm not sure if I should open up the phone lines for that one or not, to be quite frank.
You'd better intro that episode with the intro to the show Cops.
Ooh, that's a good idea. So not Taylor Swift. All right.
Negative on that.
Yeah. Well, all right. I will end the recording and the live broadcast. If you guys want to hang out for just a minute, we'll chit chat. But otherwise, everyone else that tuned in, appreciate the comments that came through in the chat. Yeah. Enjoy the rest of your day and week. Thanks for listening.